You're listening to another impactful episode of the Combinate Podcast, the show where we drive for quality in everything, because quality is everything. I'm your host, Subi Sade. I've been working on medical devices, pharmaceuticals, and combination products for the last 10 years, and my goal is to understand. Each week, I sit down with leaders to understand and bring together medtech and biotech in order to examine the roadblocks in development and access we face and bring to light concepts and tools from our industry and others to help address those. Thank you for joining me, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Combinate Podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sade. We are graced and honored today by Chris Tsai. Chris is the Director of Implementation Services at DFMA as part of the Boothroyd Dewhurst Company, and has a wide career in value engineering, commercialization, and really the good stuff, some of the coolest elements of quality engineering. And, Chris and I met, I challenged him to see if he remembered me when he gave me a training about 10 years ago. But, the training that I got was really foundational for me and was tremendously important in how I just started to view things. I was a young engineer at the time and was working on a few different things, but it was like the guru telling you form over, function over form and that type of thing. And so it was a multi-day training, and I just remember coming out of it like really excited to use the tool, and from there was able to see a lot of benefit from it. So I wanted to bring Chris on to talk about value engineering and design for manufacturability and assembly, some philosophically, some more in action. But welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So I guess before we go ahead and get started, can you just talk a little bit about your career? Because you started out at Eastman Kodak in its heyday, and then moved into the DFMA world.
Yeah. So I'm a Purdue mechanical engineering grad, and I started at Kodak in the mid 80s, initially as an automation engineer. But truth be told, I only worked on one automation project in my entire career. I joined Kodak in the heyday. I think we were somewhere around 120 to 140,000 employees worldwide. Back then film was king, and we were number one. I worked predominantly on the equipment side. And so I worked on projects that would consume the film, paper, and chemistry. We were kind of the, pardon the expression, bastard stepchild, if you will, of the company, because, we didn't make any money. It's all the film side and chemistry side that made all the money.
Necessary evil.
That's right. Razor blade kind of a model. So I got involved with DFMA and value engineering as a result of a couple of pretty significant missteps in product development that Kodak made. And Kodak invested quite a bit of money, frankly, in bringing in some worldwide experts to figure out how we might not make those missteps in the future. Don Clausing and Genichi Taguchi being two of the most prominent consultants that we brought in.
Whoa.
And they taught us a lot. Yeah. We learned a lot. And as a result of that engagement, we re-engineered the product development process. And part of that is what got me involved with DFMA and value engineering.
So the missteps in those cases were like
you know, the solution was not to try to address the product. It was to try to address the product development
process.
And so how did it change?
So historically, and unfortunately, this is still largely the case for most companies. The product development process has a very short, typically underfunded and understaffed, quote unquote, concept stage. For most product development processes, it's the first stage gate in their process, right?
We got a concept, we're flying, right?
Yeah. Yep. At Kodak, parts of Kodak, we called it feasibility stage. And the whole point there was to come up with a concept, prove that the concept would work. That's the feasibility part. And that was kind of the end zone that you had to get through in order to get more funding, right? The problem with that process is that the engineering team, again, understaffed and underfunded, did the best that they could with duct tape and bubble gum to come up with something that would work, not necessarily the best solution, right? There's nothing in there in the process that that definitively pushes you towards identifying the quote-unquote optimal solution. And so what you end up proving as being feasible, you then through brute force try and drive it to the finish line. And that's how you end up getting systems that are low reliability, very poor robustness, way too expensive to produce, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So you're essentially, you're already starting from behind, trying to fix a design that was rushed or that was, you know.
Yeah. And if you think about, you know, any kind of a problem solving approach, you know, you could be, I don't know, working in your yard and something goes wrong. Everybody's problem solving approach generally is going to be somewhat of a trial and error based on your previous experiences, right? And the whole point there is really to stop the bleeding and get things working again. And I fully understand that there's lots of value in that. That should not be your approach to product development, right? So, you know, the first idea that you come up with in product development generally is not going to be the best idea. And if you brute force that to the finish line, you're just not going to get something that has got some, you know, good legs under it. So, so what we learned from Don Clausing and the others was that there were a number of engineering practices that other companies were using that we at Kodak were not. And these various tools and techniques made up what Don ended up calling concurrent engineering. So we were right on the forefront of really kind of learning about and inventing the concept of concurrent engineering. In several cases, we deployed these techniques and engineering practices to great effect. But in many cases, we also reverted back to the old way of doing things. So you know, having a great process is no guarantee, you know, world-class product.
So I mean, you talked about concurrent engineering there, sort of being in its infancy after, you know, you got the, say, quality powerhouses coming in. But what else changed from the product development process? Because concurrent engineering is not, I mean, doesn't address what you were talking about in terms of the rushing of the concept.
Correct. Yeah. So our process changed whereby we essentially added a phase to our process. And as I've gone around the country in the consulting role, I think our process ended up being somewhat unique. We added a phase just after the concept phase that we affectionately called the make it break phase. And I love this approach, frankly. So the concept phase is a little bit different in that you're not just looking for one feasible solution. The intent is that you would be trying to identify multiple feasible solutions. So the concept phase, we called it the make it work phase. And then the phase that we added was the make it break phase, AKA the robustness phase, where we would throw noise at these various concepts to understand their performance response surface, to use a statistical term.
What does that mean?
That means that across various responses, performance elements, that we are monitoring how that performance varies under sources of variation. So that those sources of variation, the typical things are things like environmental. So ranges in temperature, ranges in humidity, ranges in atmospheric pressure. It could be use case abuses, right? So as a user using this piece of equipment, how might they abuse that equipment? And the ultimate goal is to come up with a design concept, a system level concept that is impervious or insensitive to those sources of variation. And that's the definition of robustness.
Yeah. So was it, I mean, in that case, was it just a bunch of like coarse screening type DOEs?
Yeah. And this is where Taguchi came in. So these were highly fractionalized DOEs that we are trying to, as quickly as we can with minimal trials, understand which of these concepts is likely to be the most robust solution. Again, we've got numerous case studies where we use that to great effect, simplifying or shortening that development process, allowing us to pick technical solutions that allowed the team to then move into the detailed design phase and really start to put meat on the bones.
Hmm. And so that second phase, the make it break phase, was called what?
We call that a robustness phase.
Robustness.
Or system optimization phase.
And then you move into?
And then we move into the detailed design phase, which is typically the second phase of most companies' product development process.
Okay. And so it went concept, robustness, design. And so design is where you're putting together your specs and drawings and, you know, exactly. Test methods, yep. And all that.
Yep. You've got, you know, you're creating engineering models, you're running, you know, actual tests to verify and validate design, verify performance.
So V&V is part of design.
V&V is part of, it starts in the design phase and carries on into your manufacturing ramp phase. So it's obviously most companies are not going to start their manufacturing ramp until they have that objective data to confirm that the design is meeting intent. But that V&V work must continue into the ramp phase, collecting data so that you understand reliability performance as well, right?
Sure. Okay. So essentially you're saying the V&V done in design is the sort of preliminary, and the manufacturing ramp is really your final. And so, you know, you're essentially spot checking as you're going through your design phase. Am I still golden?
Yeah. So my experience with on the med device side is you have design validation and process verification, right? So, so design validation is that piece that it's that objective evidence that allows you to move in essentially manufacturing ramp, and then process validation is proof that you can actually repetitively produce those design.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. So the highly fractionalized DOEs, right? Do you have any stories about, you know, what those came out with?
Unfortunately, I don't. My colleague Skip Krevling, he led that charge. He actually spent quite a bit of time with Dr. and. Yeah, I would actually encourage you to reach out to him. I can facilitate that. Skip and I are still in touch today.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll do that. So it's hilarious, you know. Once you get two people who are into quality talking, like, we haven't even started talking about value engineering really, and it's been almost a half hour. So what is value engineering?
So value engineering, and again, my I'm an old school, quote unquote, old school value engineer. Larry Miles is recognized as being kind of the inventor of this this approach. And what he realized is that customers typically buy function. That's what they care about. They won't necessarily explicitly be able to articulate that, but at the core, we are all value driven consumers. And I'll give you a very specific example. Everybody out there has a cell phone, pretty much, and you know, every time Apple comes out with a new one, I just announced 14. You know, we start going through this process of kind of comparing and contrasting the new model as compared to the old model, or Apple versus Android, or, you know, et cetera, right? And what we're looking at, without really knowing it, is, you know, things like battery performance, image quality on the cameras, memory storage capacities, right? Screen size, touch screen capability, yada, yada, right? So these are all at the core functions that these products must perform. And we, as the consumers, are comparing the performance of these functions across all of the different options and weighing those against cost. So value is a really fairly simple ratio of functionality in the numerator and cost in the denominator. Now, there's a lot of things that affect both numerator and denominator. And at the core is the design of the equipment to begin with, right? The design pegs everything. And so if you think about what we just talked about from a, you know, robustness perspective and reliability perspective, that's squarely in the numerator, right? It's the performance of those functions, how well they perform, how efficiently they can be performed, and how well they stand up against sources of variation. And the kind of the cat's meow is, if you can provide a product or a system that performs extremely well at costs that are below expectations, if you can come out with a high value, you know, using that ratio, a high value solution, that solution should sell itself off the shelves. And so that's kind of the core of value engineering. Value engineering is a set of tools and techniques to assess both numerator and denominator of that value equation, and to drive innovation around those functions to try and, you know, obviously maximize it.
So I didn't hear you say anything about cost reduction. Is it not cost reduction?
many companies today will include cost reduction as an objective, most certainly. But unfortunately, cost reduction typically pays no attention to function. Cost reduction typically is squarely focused on the denominator of the equation, you know, just pulling at all the strings that might reduce cost. And if you're not paying attention, the problem with that approach is that you'll affect the numerator and not really know it. So, you know, the typical quote unquote value engineering of today is, you know, can we find an alternate material that costs less per pound? And you might find one, there's lots of materials out there, but you also potentially weaken the part and therefore affect the numerator, right? You know, go ahead.
I was going to say, so, I mean, you've worked with a ton of companies, and, you know, I had the great fortune, I think, to, work under a set of engineers that came from Motorola. And so they invited me to think a little bit differently about these things. How do you, cause it's not a stretch to try to fit cost. And cost is such an objective thing sometimes that, you know, you had mentioned that a lot of companies are starting to do value engineering, right? So how do I go in and demonstrate, you know, value to my own company? Look at how much cost we reduced. How do you get companies or individuals to, because what you're saying makes sense. but like all things that make sense in life, it's easier said than done. So what advice do you have for getting through that resistance?
So your question is spot on. The companies that are executing or have value engineering groups or individuals today, generally speaking, are really doing cost reduction, not truly value engineering or value analysis. And the key distinction there is that they're solely focused on the denominator, and they're not generally paying any attention to the performance of the functions. And so the kind of the secret sauce and what makes it more challenging is how do you define and ultimately quantify the numerator, the function piece of that equation. Larry Miles and those of us trained in value engineering, we use verb noun pairs to define functions. So to give you an overly simplistic example of that, I drive a car every day, and the functional purpose of driving the car is to move me, right? So move being the verb and me being the noun, or move stuff, or haul dirt. There's lots of reasons why you might own a vehicle, right?
Sure.
So the genius behind this approach of verb noun pairs to define functions is that it forces you to boil down what you're thinking about to its simplest terms. And that is, in fact, way more difficult than it sounds. And you start to understand some of the complexities that are involved in a system. And you start thinking about what are all the verb noun pairs of what it is I'm using or what it is that I'm designing. The internal combustion engine is going to have thousands of verb noun pairs that describe functionally what is required to make that engine work. And you start to really understand how complex the internal combustion engine is, right? So there's great power, in my experience, in defining the functional requirements of a system using verb noun pairs. But again, it's not the typical way that we think. As engineers, we're certainly not taught this approach in engineering school. And so because it's kind of different and not something that's common, I think industry tends to ignore it. They bypass it and stick with what they know, which is cost.
And so, essentially the verb noun pairs is the silver bullet. In some ways, because it brings you to understand, because in trying to reduce the cost, right, you may affect the numerator without knowing it. Yeah. And so we have a thing in risk management in the medical device space. You want to make sure that a risk control that you implement doesn't create other risks, right? Right. And so it's the same idea. But rather than focus on the cost is is not the focus of value engineering, right? So essentially just put a pause on it, whatever it is, and really quantify the function. And you said the verb noun pairs. So, you talked about combustion engine. Can you maybe use a different example? Cause it's not fully, I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying. I just don't get how you'd quantify function. That's what's missing.
Yeah. Right. So let's go back to my Kodak days, right? So why would we want to take a picture, right? Whether we're using a cell phone, a digital camera, a film camera, a video recorder, what are we trying to achieve as the user of that piece of equipment or that system? And in verb noun pairs, what I would pose to you is that the primary function there is to capture of memories, right? Mm-hmm. To capture and store memories.
Yep.
And so when you think about that, you can ask yourself, well, how do we achieve that? And if you answer that how with additional verb noun pairs, you start to understand what are the functional requirements for a system. So, you know, we need to capture light, we need to focus photons, we need to store those photons, et cetera, right? So, and as you continue to ask how, you start to get into the actual design of the system. You have to actually start to make some decisions about technical approach. And once you get there to that decision point, that's where quantification starts to need to happen, right? So you need to start to understand what are some of the key factors that that we need to monitor, measure, and design for. So the ability to collect light, you know, there's a number of metrics that we can start to put around that, right? So one of Larry Miles's rules was, when you define verb noun pairs, the verb should be actionable. In other words, you know, when you hear that verb, it should bring an image to your head. So capture, you can, I would hope you can start to have all sorts of different images come into your head. Okay. And then the noun should be ideally measurable, right? So gathering light, we can measure light, right? In terms of lumens. Those measurable nouns, we can start to quantify the performance of different options. We can actually start to then do performance tests and those robustness tests around those different options. And hopefully you've already kind of gone through the thought process as you heard me talk about verb noun pairs, to recognize that for any given verb noun pair, there might be half a dozen or more different technical solutions and ways in which you achieve that function. And so as you kind of march down those different technical solutions, quantification of performance against those functions starts to become very evident.
Does Larry Miles have any books or content?
That's a great question. I've never been asked that before. The followers of Larry Miles most certainly have been prolific. My mentor at Kodak that taught me value engineering actually published a very good book on value engineering. Larry Shillitoe. Larry was a master photographer at Kodak and one of the few value engineers, certified value engineer. And he was my mentor. He taught me all about value engineering and voice of the customer. He's a spectacular individual.
That's so cool. And do you know what his book is called?
Value, : it's Design, Measurement, and something else. My memory.
Very good.
Failing.
I'll look it up. I just wanted some Google search terms. Okay. So then this verb noun pair. I mean, so this is, I think, something that, because you know, I saw ISO 9001, right? Product realization. So you know, in many regulated industries, whether it's medical device or aviation or whatever, right? There are rules and requirements, and particular quality system requirements, I think, for those types of industries. And so, you know, the like design control as part of product realization is often looked at as it's something that we must do. But I mean, what was that like in the, say, a Kodak, which is, you know, not really regulated? Because it sounds exactly like user needs, design inputs, and that it's certainly a different approach. In terms of systems engineering, how you actually get right to the measurable characteristics, but this is what it sounds like. It's a more, I'm going to try to pick the right word here. It sounds like it's a more precise thought exercise than what are our user needs and how do we trace them to measurable design inputs, right? Like the verb noun thing of looking at what is the high level function. And then from there, what do we actually need to do to meet that, right? We can we can get, for example, right? Like, I'll just go through quickly. Capture memories. Okay, capture memories needs to involve actually picking when like picking a shot or picking the shot. You can do that with a button. You can do that with whatever, right? And so the button will have the time for it to actually take the picture, or it'll have how much force it is required, how big it is, or whatever, right? And so I understand, sort of, but it's not how things are done in regulated industry, at least in my experience. So if you can talk about design
control. Well, and any of the industry, in my experience,
nobody does this.
Very few. Value engineering today is predominantly in the large structures kind of industry. So shipbuilding, aircraft building, city design, infrastructure, urban infrastructure and things like that. Civil engineers, frankly, are the largest exercisers of value engineering.
You mean true value engineering?
True value engineering, right? Exactly. Now, you kind of stumbled upon or maybe logically came to kind of an interesting feature within value engineering. We talk about the function of capture image, and you logically got to the point of push button. Push button would be viewed in value engineering terms as the user function. Right. Mm-hmm. So when the user performs that action of pushing a button, it cascades through the functions that you design into the system that allow the end game primary function to be achieved, which is capture image or capture memory. Right. And there's some technical decisions that have to be made and then ultimately designed for in the middle to allow that user function to lead to that primary function of capture memory. So you can connect all the dots through a value engineering effort using a value engineering tool called a value graph and a FAST diagram. To your question about, how do you, regulated companies have to show traceability of the design intent to actual execution, right? And we have to show through objective evidence that the design that we've created actually meets the requirements as defined in the specifications document. We've got all these tools out there to help us do that in the regulated world. How do non-regulated companies do that? Well, I think it's predominantly recognized as a VOC tool, voice of the customer tool, and that is QFD, quality function deployment. And not to say that QFD is being used explicitly or strictly by companies to do this. It's really a QFD-like process. So let me talk about QFD for a minute, and then I'll get back to your question. QFD talks about the quote-unquote house of quality, which is the documentation of all the customer requirements and performance expectations of a system. And then you go through the various quote-unquote houses of QFD to deploy those requirements right down to design specifications. And if you can even go beyond that to process design and process specifications. So how are those parts being made? What materials are being used? How do you know that the materials are quality materials, et cetera, et cetera? Right? And so you can show linkage from customer expectations all the way down through this logical decision tree to actual manufacturing process and performance of the process, right? And that general approach is how some companies, I would probably overly generalize them as Six Sigma enlightened companies, to ensuring that the design is meeting intent, right? So again, if you talk to Skip, he'll talk about this kind of V-shaped approach. Coming down on the one side of the V is the deployment of those customer requirements from actual performance down to actual, you know, specifications of parts and dimensions and tolerances and things like that. And then going up the other side of the V is the actual demonstrated execution or achievement of those requirements, right? So it's
I've seen that diagram before. So
great.
It's clear.
Yep.
So you're saying that though they don't need to jump through many of the hoops that a regulated industry had, there's still at least typically the V in those Six Sigma Enlightened companies. I guess the House of Quality?
Yes.
What is that? Is that the V or?
So the House of Quality is the first house in a QFD process. And the House of Quality is what it first translates voice of the customer. So the needs, preferences, and expectations of the customer, the user of the system, into the technical requirements at the system level. And in the truest form of QFD, quality function deployment, and the House of Quality, you would also include in that benchmarking information. So how are other competitive products or other solutions providing those technical solutions, and how well are they performing against the needs, preferences, and expectations of the customer? Right.
Understood. Yeah. So I want to move on because we're getting close to time, and I want to talk about the DFMA tool a little bit. So, I was trained on it, like I said, somewhere between 8-10 years ago. I don't remember, but I found tremendous value in it. Was working on products that had lots of parts. Mm-hmm. And so was able to actually eliminate, combine, and so on. And you had taught me the phrase of the easiest part to manage is the one that doesn't exist, right? So
right.
I would add is the easiest document to manage is the easiest relationship to manage is the easiest whatever, right? So
exactly.
And I think, do you know who H. James Harrington is?
Yes.
He wrote on Costa Quality and Costa Poor Quality. I've had him on the show, and he was talking about how, you know, his dad would control chart his grades, and you know how he'd use a lot of like the quality engineering tools in his real life. And he said a saying that our work life is important, but our personal life is more important. And so if our work expectations for quality are great, our quality expectations at home need to be superb. He riffed a little bit about how he leverages the quality engineering mindset at home. And it was really cool, but you know, that's where I was drawing a parallel. Anyways, I guess moving on to the tool, right? Cause I remember there were, when you would go in, you would enter a part, you'd give it a name and stuff like that. And then it'll ask you a series of questions like how much does it weigh, and, you know, what type of operations are associated with it? Mm-hmm. Is the intent for it to just combine to be fastened against two components, or does it actually have another operation that it's doing? And I always thought about like these questions are like two or three options, right? They're not rocket science type questions. They're not like what type of resin is it, or when you get into the part module, yes, you can do cost estimates as far as I can remember based on different grades of steel or different, you know, if it's a sheet metal process or if it's injection molding with certain, you know, how much cavities is it and what's the intended volume. So that's the part module, but as far as the assembly bit, I remember just, and I never asked the question, so it I guess it's still a burning question, like the questions are so high level, but I feel like so intentional, you know, why are those such important questions, and how much cost is associated with a part that is just used to fasten, or, has a nesting feature or can rotate about its axis or is symmetrical whatever, right? Like all the different.
Yeah. So Doctors Boothroyd and Dewhurst, the namesakes of the company I work for, they invented DFMA. And at the core are these questions that you're talking about, what we refer to as minimum part criteria. And, you know, at its core, minimum part criteria is function oriented. And I should ask Jeff sometime. I don't honestly know if Jeff Boothroyd was deliberate in these questions being function oriented, or if he came to that conclusion on his own, or if he was hobnobbing with Don Clausing or something. but the minimum part criteria is specifically function oriented. And the beauty in that is that it is agnostic to solution, to technical solution, right? You come at these questions with a technical approach in your head, with a fundamentally a design concept in your head. And on a part-by-part basis, you basically have to functionally justify each part, right? Now, many parts will be multifunctional in their purpose, in their intent, right? But some parts are unifunctional. They perform one and only one function in the design. And the most ubiquitous of that in almost every design out there is the screw, right? It's a threaded fastener. Almost all, 99%+ of the screws out there are being utilized in a functional way to do one and only one thing, and that's to hold two or more other parts together. So they're fastening and by definition, those parts are candidates for elimination. So DFA early on was recognized and kind of accused of being a process that was just trying to eliminate all screws. That's not really an accurate or well understood comment on the approach. The intent is for us to be deliberate in our use of threaded fasteners, right? Threaded fasteners have their place in the world, in the design world.
I remember going through and, you know, looking at screws in particular, and, you know, it was like, because some items required service, you would have, yes. you needed to be able to take them apart and things like that. And sometimes the reliability just wasn't there in anything other than a screw. And so that was required. But it also invited us, well, we need to make sure we have good screws, you know?
And good so screws, the right number of screws.
Right. Yep. And so that's a good point. Keep going. Sorry.
Yep. Yep. So screws are one of those unifunctional items. The other unifunctional item are items that purely connect. So wires, hoses, and tubes are examples of parts that, you know, they're passing a fluid or passing electrical signal from one end to the other. They perform no other function other than to quote unquote connect the dots. And again, those connecting items are always candidates. So the three main minimum part criteria that Dr. Boothroyd and Dr. Dewhurst invented was relative motion, different or unique material required, and that the part must be separate and unique for purposes of assembly or disassembly, principally assembly. And if you stop and think about those three criteria, again, they're function oriented, and they are kind of first principles oriented, if you will, right? So relative motion, like a piston in the engine of your car, that motion is required in order to compress fuel. And notice I'm using verb noun pairs here. Compress fuel, ignite fuel, generate power, right? If the piston doesn't move within the engine block, you're not able to perform those functions, right? So again, relative motion is kind of a physics-based kind of a thing. Different material or unique material. speaks to material properties. And again, it's a, you know, this is a technical function oriented kind of requirement, right? And then separate to allow assembly gets to the whole issue with accessibility, right? So in a gearbox, I have to be able to put the gears and the gear fluid in, or this is not going to last long. It's not going to perform well, right? So the cover to the gearbox has to be separate and removable. You know, so it boils down, much like function analysis, these minimum part criteria boil down the design into its core minimalist, theoretical, most ideal solution if we were to ignore all practical elements of cost, manufacturing capability, et cetera, right? So through the minimum part criteria, we can define a theoretical, most elegant solution that is, in most cases, unobtainable. And the process then guides us through coming off of that theoretical to a more practical solution. And by coming up with a practical solution, by starting off at a theoretical best, what we typically end up with is a much more elegant solution than if we do the trial and error approach that most companies use.
Yeah. And it invites you to think about each and every part, its intended function, and in a different way. And I remember it would give you recommendations like this one should sort of for sure be eliminated. This one should be considered for combination and so yep. on. I guess moving into the part module, because this one, the part module, I actually remember, I thought it was really cool and very, what's the word I'm looking for? Detailed.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how the tool has changed. You know, I imagine it's only grown in libraries, but, you know, if you look at for the sake of example, a cast part, mm-hmm. you know, you could add in secondary operations mm-hmm. that would be required. You could look at the different grades of metal that you know mm-hmm. you would use. You would look at the tooling. You'd look at where is it being manufactured and all these things.
Yep.
And it was a situation where you could reduce. If you maintained the part exactly the same, you could look at what you could do to reduce the cost either by increasing volume or increasing cavitation or mm-hmm. you know, whatever. But then it would also, I remember, look at the surface edges of the part and tell you, you know, simplify, right?
Right.
And so for that, I have a couple of questions. I'll let you maybe explain the part module mm-hmm. before I ask a couple questions.
Sure. So let me rewind a little bit. DFA, minimum part criteria, directly aligns with value engineering because ultimately what we're trying to do is provide full functionality at the highest performance levels at the lowest cost, right? And what Drs. Boothroyd and Dewhurst discovered is that part count is the single primary driver to system level cost, right? So DFA is most definitely one of those key value engineering. Now, what they also discovered early on is that, you know, when you conceptualize a multifunctional part as part of a DFA approach, that multifunctional part may or may not be economical to produce, right? And so they needed an analytical technique where you could start to pull some data together on cost to produce a part. And that was the genesis of our DFM concurrent costing tool. And early on, the whole intent was, you know, to use George Box's quote, all models are wrong, some are useful. The whole intent behind DFM originally was let's create a useful tool so that engineers can make good decisions about their designs in terms of part combination, part merging, and part elimination. And, you know, not worry too much about, you know, all of the different unique levers that you can pull in a manufacturing process. You know, let's, you know, focus on providing good enough information so those engineers can make good decisions. And that worked fine, except engineers being who they stereotypically are, we wanted more, right? We want all of those levers. We know that there's all this detail, and frequently we'll get mired in that detail. But so Boothroyd and Dewhurst responded, and the DFM tool today does provide all of those levers that allow you to get a cost estimate right down to the penny with those kinds of accuracies. And most recently, we also now have the ability to add on in what we call independent elements of cost, so that you can actually do a quotation comparison. So if you're sourcing your parts from a supplier, and you're doing the typical RFQ kind of process, you can use this model now to evaluate those quotations coming back, to ensure that the quotations are fair and credible, that they've incorporated, those detail elements that lead to cost, and maybe most appropriately, that the suppliers are not including exorbitant amount of profit or other independent elements of cost that you rightfully shouldn't have to pay for, right? So it brings transparency to the supply chain in ways that I don't in other tools. Right?
So that was one of the questions that I had is if you're, let's say, because that becomes really valuable if you're sourcing a custom component where you're transferring your design.
Yep.
What about if you're sourcing an existing component that's, say, a commercial off-the-shelf type component, or one that's modified off the shelf to meet additional acceptance criteria, essentially same mm-hmm. design, but through a tighter funnel. Mm-hmm. Can tools like that be used or what is your experience with that?
Yeah, so typically commoditized items, commercial off the shelf kinds of items, there's not a lot of value in using our DFM tool on those components, because they're typically made in the gazillions kind of quantity, right? And you're using a small percentage of the produced quantity. A modified COTS item, commercial off-the-shelf item, you could definitely use this tool for that, because someone is taking that common part and modifying it. And you want to, again, model that modification and make sure that it's, number one, being done correctly and to your expectations. Number two, that you're not paying more for it than you should. So you could certainly use the greatest benefit, though, in the use of the DFM concurrent costing tool is really on those custom manufactured components. And much like function parts, multifunctional custom produced parts can be typically produced in a multitude of different manufacturing processes using a multitude of different materials. And a design engineer or a designer that is creating those specifications does so based on their own experiences in their past history, right? How have we made parts like this in the past?
Yeah.
That doesn't anywhere come close to guaranteeing that it's the optimal solution, right? And so the biggest benefit in the use of this, of our DFM tool, is really to quickly evaluate all of those different options and make sure that you're choosing the material process combination that is likely to lead you to the lowest cost solution. And you can do that in a matter of minutes, use of our tool. And now you have data helping you with your decision-making rather than purely experiential and kind of gut feel.
I mean, I remember it was insanely detailed on the DFM module. Unbelievably so. And if my memory is right, for each different type of process, it would ask you different questions. So if it's a thermoform part,
exactly right,
it'd be talking about the die, and if it's a injection molded part, it would be talking about the mold and, like I said, cavitation, but also what type of ejection is it, and yep, all this stuff. You're right, because I've worked with really talented, really experienced design engineers. Some of them that, you know, had a history of designing tools or, you know, like they know what they're doing. It's not like they're just designing models. But even then, it, you know, it's just, I think, hard to take that disciplined of an approach on each part just based on your experience.
Right. And so here's one of the rubs, if you will. You know, companies today were hiring mechanical engineers coming out of school. I have two sons that fall into that category. That, you know, they're coming out of engineering school, and, you know, as mechanical engineers are being plopped in front of a CAD terminal and expected to start designing parts and products.
Huh.
They've never seen the inside of a shop, right? They don't know an injection molding machine from a die casting machine from a sand casting factory. Yeah, you know, so how can we legitimately expect these engineers to design cost-effective solutions? Right. So giving them a tool like this, number one, is going to enable them to generate data to make better decisions. But maybe more importantly, at least in my view, it's going to force them to be humble about what they know and what they don't know. It gives them a venue to learn things about these manufacturing processes. And like I say, to be humble about what they don't know and to go out and ask questions. So the sooner and faster that these young engineers can gain experience, real world experience in an actual manufacturing facility with actual parts, the sooner and faster that they're going to become very talented, effective design engineers.
Yeah, because if, especially if their focus is design, right? I mean, understanding which watchouts to look for each different process does a lot. Actually, now that I remember it, there was like a help function that showed all the different processes, right? And so, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I'm like going down memory lane. And when you said shop just now, I remember doing a machined part, and I was just like, I couldn't believe how much detail was in, you know. Yep. In that. So that's really cool. I guess, go on.
Yeah. The details, you know, obviously the detail has to be there to enable, should costing and could costing to the penny kind of capabilities. Right. But when you're in the early stages of designing a part, number one, you don't know enough to be able to answer those detailed questions. And number two, those detailed questions aren't appropriate at the time because you're really trying to make sure that you're making good high level decisions, material and processes. So kind of the trick to the effective use of DFM concurrent costing is clearly understanding what questions you're trying to answer, where you are in the design process, and controlling, if you're the stereotypical engineer, controlling your emotions and your desire for that detailed information until it's appropriate, right? So the software will provide default values for all those details, but, you know, tweaking those detailed elements has no real credible impact on the design of your part yet, right? Because you're still kind of conceptualizing the shape, look, and feel of it. As you mature that design and get to actually defining features, defining dimensions and tolerances, that's when some of those details start to be important. And so there's an evolution and a maturity in the use of the DFM tool that goes hand in glove with the evolution and maturity of the design of the part itself.
Yeah, don't get caught up. And it, you know, essentially, I guess what I heard from you is, if it's early on, you can decide what type of strategy that you're going to implement on the tooling and, you know, look at, say, volumes and say, well, we really save a lot of money by doubling the cavitation, or know, we could stick with much less cavitation based on the volume, whatever, right.
So you know, if you don't have somebody screaming in your ear already, you know, you might be designing a molded part, for example, that as you put more and more features onto that molded part, you actually limit the amount of cavitation that you can incorporate into your tooling, right? You might build unintentionally be forcing quote unquote action into the tool, right? Lifters and side poles and things like that. You know, any tool engineer that's watching over your shoulder is going to yell at you, wait a minute, you're adding cost to the tooling. You're inducing opportunities for defects into the part. You're extending the cycle time required to produce that part. Redesign that part or design that part differently to try and keep the tool so it's open and closed. It has no action, right? So DFM concurrent costing, if you're using the tool in the way it's intended, will provide some of that feedback to you that you might otherwise historically have gotten from a tool engineer. Those tool engineers are very rare these days.
I guess we're over time here, but I wanted to ask you, you already mentioned a couple books. What is a book that changed your life?
Larry Shillitoe's book on value engineering is right at the top of the list. And The Goal.
Okay.
Theory of Constraints. Right at the top of the list. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And I'm a Boy Scout, so his Boy Scout story and The Goal, it resonates so well with me. So
that's cool. And what is something you're excited about?
I am really excited about in today's industrial world about how the U.S. has been reshoring, bringing work back from Asia. My last job at Kodak was to move work to Asia, and I hated it. I have always been a make it domestic kind of a engineer. And so I'm really thrilled to see how companies are starting to move that work back, but I'm also distressed because, having three young boys, I know that the schools, the high schools continue to push college. And we're not emphasizing the value of the trades as we should. So I'm right behind Mike Rowe in trying to get schools to pay attention to the trades and to get kids to pay attention to the trades and be thinking about how they might make a wonderful life by being a skilled trades kind of individual. And if you've ever played the game of life, it's so accurate, right? I mean, that first kind of fork in the road is, are you going to go and work, or are you going to go and go to college? And fundamentally, that's really where we're at. And we're, in my opinion, pushing way too many kids into the college route. We need skilled trades, and we need individuals that can, design parts, make parts, put parts together, do all the automation, do all the coding. That's so important for our future.
Yeah, I have a distant relative who wanted to do mechanical engineering, but started working at a machine shop. And this was a couple of years ago, and just fell in love with it. Yeah. Like he couldn't go back.
Yeah.
Couldn't go back to school. And, you know, now he's managing the shop, and he recently moved into a really big company, super talented, but awesome. You know, he's doing well for himself. But yeah, I mean, totally. Because I think, and you can draw the parallel of tech, right? I mean, I have a bunch of friends that work at like Facebook and Google and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. and I was talking to one of them about, you know, how much do they like reimburse as far as, you know, education and stuff like that. And he goes, it's sort of antithetical that, you know, that they're not going to invest in you going and getting a PhD. Maybe if it's this thing that's like super nuanced that
right.
you can't just learn on your own, but you know, right. many of the CEOs and that they didn't finish. Right. And so, right. really, and so exactly. to say like, yeah, so it's, I thought that was really interesting. Well, yeah. Very, very good. Any final thoughts?
No, I think we've covered a lot of ground.
Yeah,
more than what I was expecting.
Yeah, we really did.
All good.
A last thing is how can people reach you?
I would encourage people to go to the dfma.com website and explore DFMA and the little bit of value engineering that we have there, and of course my contact information and biographical information is there.
Awesome.
So, please reach out. And then also, of course, on LinkedIn.
Thank you for coming on, Chris. Glad
thank
to,
you for
glad
having
to
me.
talk to
This
you.
was great.
Yep.